From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. There's a whooping cough outbreak in North Idaho, and the avian flu is spreading. Dr. David Pate, the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, is joining us today to talk more about all of this, as well as Idaho Supreme Court case in regards to EMTALA. Now, if you have a public health question for Dr. Pate, make sure you send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Dr. Pate will be with us the entire hour, so if you get those questions in now, we will do our very best to get them in before the end of this hour. So we're going to begin today with the avian flu because it continues to spread all across the United States. And Dr. Pate, our Rachel Cohen actually sat down with the state veterinarian, Dr. Scott Libeles, I believe just yesterday. She wanted to talk about just how serious this is. So I want to play a clip because she asked him that we do know right now that there are two confirmed cases of bird flu in Idaho dairies. Dr. Libeles says there might be a third. So let's take a listen.
Nationwide, about 35 dairies have been identified as having the virus. Idaho is now up to two confirmed, and we have one presumptive we're waiting for confirmation on. And the good news is the original affected dairy, the first one, they fully recovered, and the cattle are back up to full milk production.
So, Dr. Pate, pending a third, can we start by this avian flu that we are dealing with, because it is what's being called, highly pathogenic. So can you talk about that? Because, you started talking to us about this, I believe, on March 25th. And so it's been more than a month.
That's right.
And this just keeps, spreading literally and figuratively.
It is. And it's quite surprising. So just to bring everybody up to speed, avian influenza is a influenza virus that originates in birds, and usually waterfowl, who then, when they're migrating, they, through their excrement, infect other birds, poultry, domestic birds, that kind of thing. The reference to highly pathogenic means that when it infects poultry and domestic birds, it largely kills them. There might be some that survive, but most will die. That's the highly pathogenic. As opposed to a lot of avian influenza viruses that are low pathogenic, because they will infect birds, but they don't kill them. So that's the basis for that terminology. These are influenza A viruses, but they are not the same viruses that we deal with every year. And when we just went through our flu season, of course, as you know, and we talked about it a lot on your show, and when we talked about influenza A, in that case, we were talking about so-called H1 and H3, which were the circulating kinds. The highly pathogenic one is H5 that's circulating. And so what is concerning is that normally this just infects birds. And then we have to cull chickens, egg prices go up, that kind of thing. What's disturbing is that since about 2021, this virus has started infecting a lot of mammals. And that's distinctly unusual, except for isolated sporadic cases. But in this case, it's infecting a whole bunch of species that we've never seen get infected before, and a lot of them. Then most recently, as you mentioned, at the end of March, we detected the first outbreak in dairy cows in a Texas dairy farm. Mm-hmm. And then we started seeing this show up in other dairy farms. It's now in 9 states, and including ours. And now we have at least 2, and as the state veterinarian was saying, perhaps 3 dairy farms that are affected. This is not surprising because we're seeing this spread all through the country and involve both dairy farms and poultry farms.
Well, and Dr. Pate, as you said, you know, how it's spreading to all of these other mammals, and we touched on this before, but something making headlines right now is that there was a dolphin in the state of Florida that died. and they have confirmed it was this strain of avian flu. But we've seen, I believe we talked about this before, like elephant seals and other types of seals down in South America a year ago were dying off in droves because of this.
Yes, and that is distinctly unusual. We certainly don't expect that with this virus, but obviously something has changed, and now we're seeing it. And so what the concern is, ultimately, is, first of all, with even what it's doing now, will that impact the safety and security of our food supply? And number two, is all this transmission of among various mammals now going to equip this virus to modify itself so that it can infect humans efficiently? Because even though our first human infection with this virus was in, like, if I remember right, 1997, it's only affected about 850, 860 people worldwide, and typically people that were in very close contact with birds, either in poultry work or slaughterhouses, where they had a lot of exposure to them. Those are the only people, and we didn't see them transmit it to their families, their friends, other things. So it doesn't transmit efficiently, but we know that this virus, like the SARS-CoV-2 virus that we've talked about, and like other influenza viruses, it mutates quite frequently. And therefore, the concern is it will develop mutations that will help it transmit to humans more efficiently, and God forbid, transmit between humans efficiently. That has not happened yet, but that's what the concern is.
So we're going to get to the food supply in a moment. But before we get there, Dr. Pate, we have a couple of listener questions I wanted to get to. Mark in Boise writes, "We've created a wildlife-friendly backyard in the east end of Boise. For a number of years, we've had a pair of mallard ducks who come and spend considerable time in our backyard. One of the attractions appears to be a salad bowl filled with water that serves as a duck bath and a drinking pond. With the concern of the new H5N1 virus spreading to both dairy, cattle, and other mammals, should we discourage these ducks from being in our backyard? We regularly empty and clean and refill the bowl with water. Is this a possible path for us to pick up the bird flu virus?" And Dr. Pate, he did send us a picture tonight of the ducks in the bowl, and we gave that to you to give you an idea of what he's talking about. But reading this question, I mean, I'm thinking about, we have mallard ducks in our backyard all of the time. We also have a cat who goes outside. So I'm now wondering about this question as well.
Yes. So first of all, can mallard ducks be infected with this virus? We used to think they only got the low pathogenic avian influenza viruses, but we've now demonstrated that, in fact, they can be reservoirs for this virus. And the other thing is, unlike what we were talking about, the definition for highly pathogenic is its effects on birds, particularly the poultry, and high mortality. Actually, these ducks don't appear to get visibly ill. So they could be infected and you don't know it. Now, we don't know what the scope of infection is. And I would guess at this point, chances are those are likely healthy ducks. But one doesn't know. This is a rapidly evolving situation. So here's what I would say. I love these ducks too. I would not mess with them. Let them do their thing. Enjoy seeing them, but see them from a distance. And I think it's fine if you're going to put that bowl out there. But if they do get infected with it and are able to transmit it to you, which right now that virus does not very effectively transmit to humans. So it's possible, but it's unlikely. I think the only things I'd warn you is handle anything that might have their excrement on it with gloves. Be very careful. Don't get close to, if one of the ducks is dead, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. Call the wildlife service. Don't pick up or dispose of the body yourself. And the other thing is, like in your case, Gemma, we do have to be concerned. Dogs and cats do get infected with this virus. Cats get deathly ill from this virus. And they develop neurologic symptoms and then rapidly decline. And we've already had six cats die from this on farms. Dogs can also get infected. They usually appear like they don't get as sick as cats do, but apparently beagles are disproportionately susceptible to this virus. I don't know why the veterinarian would. No, I don't. But the point being is that if you're going to let your dogs outside, first of all, make sure there aren't any carcasses in your backyard or wherever it is you're taking. If you're walking them, don't let them, if you find that there's a bird, doesn't seem to be moving, don't let them get up too close. Don't let them sniff, and certainly don't let them. We think a lot of the ways this gets transmitted in carnivores is through eating the dead birds. So that's what you have to be careful of.
So Dr. Pate, with that said then, I mean, I'm thinking about the Greenbelt, right? And it is notorious for having ducks and geese. I mean, I'm on it every weekend. And, you know, there's excrement everywhere this time of year. So should we just be, I'm thinking, you know, like if you're running or you're walking, you know, sometimes you can't avoid some of the excrement. I mean, how concerned should we be right now in situations like that?
Not very. I think the big thing is, the most important thing is, don't handle a dead bird and don't let your animal get a dead bird if you see one. The second is, don't get up real close to them and, you know, avoid the areas of a lot of excrement to the extent you can, but you're right, you're going to walk through it and all, and that's fine. I think that just keeping your shoes clean, be careful of just keep moving, and I think you're going to be fine. It's a low risk right now, but it is also a rapidly evolving situation. Mm-hmm. So we'll keep everybody updated.
Well, and then Mark had another question, and he wrote in, he says, has H5N1 virus been detected in organic milk that has been pasteurized? And Dr. Pate, our Rachel Cohen did ask Dr. Leibeles with the Idaho Department of Agriculture about that too. So let's take a listen.
I know there's been some news recently that genetic material from the virus has been identified in retail milk, and that's true, but you need to give it a little more context in that the genetic material does not mean there's active virus, and there's not. So pasteurization is not sterilization of the milk. Pasteurization, it heats the milk to a certain temperature for a certain period of time to inactivate any harmful pathogens, whether they be bacterial or viral. And so it's business as usual as far as grade A pasteurized dairy products go. And it's doing exactly what it was intended to do. So I think consumers should not be concerned with milk that they are buying from their retail grocery stores, outlets. Pasteurized milk products are still as safe as they were before this started.
Okay, Dr. Pate, your thoughts on that? I thought he made a good point. Pasteurization is not sterilization.
That's right. And I thought he answered it perfectly. So what happened is we've sampled commercially pasteurized milk. And with the PCR test, kind of like what we did for COVID when they stick the swab up your nose and then they send it off to a lab where we're looking for the genetic material of the virus, 1 in 5, so about 20% of the samples they tested had that genetic material. But just like our state veterinarian said, that just means that virus was in that milk at some point. But he's exactly right. When we go through the pasteurization process, which is a rapid heating for a defined period of time, that does kill most bacteria and viruses. And so that's what makes our milk safe. It doesn't make it sterile, meaning that there's nothing in there, but it just means that it's below levels that can infect you. In this case, the next step was, okay, it tested the genetic material, but if you want to find out if it's infectious, we take it, we try to grow it on chicken eggs, and if it grows, there's infectious virus. If it doesn't, there isn't. And so far, all of those cultures have been negative. So I think he answered it perfectly. Yes, the virus was coming from the cows into the milk, but the pasteurization process makes it safe. The converse, though, is important. About 4 or 5% of Americans drink unpasteurized milk. That probably is highly dangerous right now. So if you're one of them, do not drink unpasteurized milk. Do not give unpasteurized milk to your pets because we've demonstrated it can infect them. And for heaven's sakes, don't give it to an infant. Not just this, but there's many risks to unpasteurized milk.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Pate, we should note that the FDA and the CDC, I believe just a couple of minutes ago, I just pulled this up, did come out with a joint news release saying that there's been no avian flu virus detected also in things like sour cream, cottage cheese, and powdered infant formula. So I think those are important things as well, because, you know, milk is just one dairy product.
Well, that's right. And so, and I'd seen about the powdered milk and infant and toddler milk. Mm-hmm. I had not gotten this latest update, so thank you for that. I'd still worry about some of the unpasteurized cheeses, but again, okay, anything that's pasteurized, you're good to go.
Okay. Before we move on to other topics, Dr. Pate, I did want to get to one more question in regards to the avian flu, because Fred wrote in. And he asks, I'd like to hear Dr. Pate's views on national and Idaho preparedness for a human outbreak of avian flu. He said he just read Dr. Leanna S. Wen's opinion piece in the April 29th Washington Post about this.
Yeah, so I think certainly there are some things that would give us a head start if this does become a problem transmitting to humans. First of all, we have a lot of antivirals, as she points out in her article. However, at the very top of the show, Jimmy, you referenced the dolphin that died. That dolphin's genetic genetic sequence showed that the dolphin's virus had developed a mutation likely to make it resistant to that medicine. And so we haven't seen that recently in any of these dairy farmed outbreaks, but it is great that we have a lot of that antiviral, but it's possible the virus could pretty easily develop resistance to it. And of course, as in most of our drugs, the key ingredient, 90% of it comes from China. So that should still give us a little pause. And the other good thing is we know how to make vaccines. We know how to make them quickly. The cautions are that the antiviral that the Strategic National Stockpile has is approaching 20 years old. And so some of it is going to expire, and we haven't been replenishing it to my knowledge. And then the vaccines were made quite a long time ago, and I haven't seen recent studies checking the effectiveness against this particular strain. So that's information we're waiting on. I agree with her. There's no reason to panic. There seldom is, but there still is much to be done. And I wish that our agencies and our federal and state governments might be devoting more time and attention to this.
Well, Dr. Pate, I mean, is it fair to say, though, that I think maybe some folks almost feel kind of a sense of I don't want to say dread, but kind of a higher anxiety level than maybe any of us would have felt 4.5, 5 years ago, having gone through the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, there's going to be a mix. There's some people that now are kind of on the edge of their seats, but there's many more people that I'm afraid of, and what I hear from well, you know, that pandemic wasn't that bad. And I think we need to make sure that we understand a point that I've made many times on your show, Gemma, and in my book. And that is that this pandemic, we were dealing with a virus that was terrible, but had a relatively low case fatality rate, 1-2%. When we're dealing with this virus, I don't think it's quite this high because I suspect we're not capturing all the infections because we're not testing for it. But just on the basis of known cases, the mortality rate for this virus is 52%. So we're talking about a very big difference. And I think the other thing, which gives me a little pause in saying that we're well prepared, is that based on the information we have so far, this virus would be unlikely to discriminate against older people versus younger people like the SARS-CoV-2 virus did. This virus kills young people. The last death I'm aware of was a 21-year-old who was supposedly perfect healthy. So I think that, as I've mentioned before, when we talked about pandemic planning, my nightmare situation is something that is affecting children and making them extremely ill, needing critical care, because we just don't have the same capacity to deal with children like we do adults. And I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I just like to prepare for things. And I'm not sure that we've got a plan. I certainly haven't heard it.
I want to switch gears now and talk about whooping cough, Dr. Pate, because up in North Idaho, the Panhandle Health District, officials there have identified a rise in pertussis, whooping cough. And this was about 2 months after we saw some cases here in Southwest Idaho. And so, Dr. Pate, first off, for folks who may not, you know, be aware, tell us what whooping cough is, because my understanding is it's really contagious, is it not?
It is. It's a bacteria instead of a virus, and but it is very contagious. Unlike SARS-CoV-2, influenza, where you can transmit it at further distances, this one typically requires you to be in closer contact, but it's highly contagious. And so the thing about whooping cough and why it gets its name, it has a very distinctive cough if you've ever heard that. Now, not all people infected with it get that cough, but it's where oftentimes you'll hear young kids give a whole bunch of a series of coughs like, and then they go like that. And that's the whoop, the whooping cough. And when you do hear it, it's very distinctive. And so, but we have effective vaccines, and but we need to start those vaccines early in childhood. And adults, if you're pregnant, we like to get pregnant people vaccinated in their third trimester. Sometimes we'll give older people a booster, especially if they've got a new grandchild coming into the family. And what this is usually reflective of is decreased vaccination rates, which we know is a state, national, and frankly, worldwide problem. And it's a terrible shame, because to see one of these young people struggle to breathe is really just dreadful. And it doesn't just affect young people. We see teenagers get very severely ill from this. So it's a shame. It's preventable.
And let's put this in perspective. So the Panhandle Health District, in their news release today, said that the district has reported 19 confirmed cases just in Kootenai County. Dr. Pate, that's up from only 9 cases that were reported between 2021 and 2023. How significant of a difference is that?
It's notable. You know, this is not this is another case. It's not a case for panic, but it is notable. You know, we used to in the United States, we would have hundreds of thousands of cases every year before we had the vaccine. Once we started having the vaccine, we got levels down as low as about 1,000 cases in the whole United States. And so, you know, the vaccine is safe. It works. It prevents these children from having a dreadful illness. Most of the time, these infants and young children are infected by the adults taking care of them. And so it's a real shame. It's easy to prevent. We need to get vaccines. And unfortunately, people that are spreading disinformation about vaccines that we have decades of experience knowing the safe and effective are scaring people from getting their kids vaccinated. And it's a terrible problem.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Pate, in fact, the news release did say that they believe that older family members who may be unaware of a whooping cough infection have been the ones in particular maybe infecting infants, because they were saying that in adults, the early symptoms look similar to a cold.
That's right. And older adults typically don't get the whoop. They don't have that distinctive cough. That's typically what we hear in infants and very young children. So they may not realize they have the whooping cough. And that's why we need to protect these infants. And that starts with the mother getting a vaccine in the third trimester to give that baby a head start. And then we do vaccinations for the infants starting at 2 months old. And that helps protect them and keep them out of the hospital. And God forbid, there are some children that die from this disease. So that would be a terrible tragedy, since we can largely prevent this.
Let's take another break, and we will come back with Dr. David Pate. We'll talk more in depth about EMTALA and the case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court right now. Continuing our conversation with Dr. David Pate, as we talk about the case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court right now, as Idaho tries to defend its strict abortion ban. In fact, the hearings were last week in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe just 1 week ago today. So, Dr. Pate, let's begin with EMTALA itself. And what is EMTALA?
So EMTALA is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. It was actually passed in 1986 during the Reagan administration. And it was in response to some pretty dreadful cases that were happening, notably in Chicago, LA. There were a number of places where people were showing up to hospitals for care, but because they were homeless or indigent or weren't able to pay for the service or have insurance, they were taking these people and basically just dumping them off at a park or taking them somewhere without providing the care. And so the law was passed to say that if you're a hospital and you operate an emergency room and you receive Medicare funds, then you must screen everyone that shows up to your emergency room. And then there's some other implications, but I'll focus on this one, to determine if they have an emergency medical condition. Now, if they don't, EMTALA doesn't apply, and that you don't really have to provide care to them. However, if they have an emergency medical condition, and what that means is that the person faces a threat to a limb, an organ, or death, or if they're in active labor, then you must provide them with stabilizing treatment. And if you're not able to stabilize them, then you must safely transfer them somewhere that can. And so that's the EMTALA law. And then where it comes in conflict with the state law is when you're dealing with emergency medical conditions involving someone who's pregnant. Sometimes the way to stabilize the patient, unfortunately, is to terminate the pregnancy. And Idaho law says, remember, under EMTALA, it's if there's a risk of losing a limb, losing an organ, or if they are facing death. Idaho law says only the third case can you stabilize them. You cannot do a termination of pregnancy if it's just to protect the health or an organ of the mother. And so that's the conflict.
So, Dr. Pate, what we've been hearing anecdotally is that doctors, OBGYN specifically, are leaving the state of Idaho. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is terrible. First of all, we have shortages of physicians of most types here in Idaho. We particularly don't have enough obstetricians, and then another specialty that treats really high-risk pregnancies, which is called maternal-fetal medicine. And what has happened is, since the Idaho law went into effect and now makes it a crime punishable by prison time for doctors, plus a loss of their license, if they perform that termination for one of those first two conditions as opposed to the third, or even if in the third, if the prosecuting attorney and then ultimately the judge or jury determines that the physician's assessment of the risk of death wasn't reasonable, then they go to jail. Doctors have just gotten very concerned. How do we handle these tricky situations? Because it may seem very clear to courts and litigators when somebody's mm-hmm. at risk of death. It is often hazy and not entirely clear, and doctors are scared.
Why is it, why is EMTALA potentially in conflict with Idaho law as it currently stands? And Dr. Payne, we should know that you're not just a doctor, you're an attorney as well. So you know, you do understand the legal aspects of this as well.
I do. In fact, since 1995, I've been responsible at the hospitals that I've led to make sure that we're in compliance with EMTALA, because the federal government can get you in a lot of trouble if you're not. So, but I'm not an obstetrician, but let me give you an example that one of the OBs did give. And so you have a woman who has a pregnancy, and now we're talking about a pregnancy that woman really wants, is delighted about. But at 15 weeks, which is not old enough that we could have a viable child if that pregnancy was, if they were delivered, at 15 weeks, they rupture the membranes and so that amniotic fluid is gone. Sometimes there are cases where you get this spontaneous rupture of membranes. And so the water breaks, the woman comes in. Well, the problem is that generally if that goes more than 2-3 days, very high risk that they're going to get is going to get a very severe infection of the womb. And so what you have to do is deliver the baby. However, Idaho law prohibits that because it's going to cause a bad infection and it could kill the mother, but it doesn't necessarily kill the mother. So that's the bind. The physician has to stand by, cannot make the intervention. We have to wait mm-hmm. and see, is the mother going to get deathly ill? And while some people think, well, this is important pro-life, you have to understand this isn't pro-life, because that infant, there is no way the infant can survive at 15 months. And the woman cannot carry the baby without that amniotic fluid intact. And so the baby is going to be lost. Now, all we're talking about is that family also going to lose the mom? So this is not pro-life.
And she could ultimately also lose her uterus in a situation like that with a 15-week fetus when her water breaks.
Well, that's right. And so, you know, when we don't treat some of these things, these are women who want the pregnancies, who mm-hmm. desperately want to add children to their family. And now, as a result, we may make it impossible for them to have their own children.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Payne, can we talk about that a little bit more? Because I have thought about this a lot, in particular, having listened to the arguments in front of the U.S. Supreme Court last week. There almost feels as if there is a disconnect with wanted and unwanted pregnancies, with elective abortions of unwanted pregnancies versus medical terminations of wanted pregnancies. And it seems as if there are, you know, individuals who believe that pregnancy is just black and white. You get pregnant, then 9 months later, boom, there's a baby. It never happens that way or that simply.
Well, that's right. And what I have said is, it's kind of unfortunate that we use the word abortion for all of these things, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have in mind, when they're talking about abortions, these are people who have not been responsible, who have gotten pregnant, and then that's inconvenient or unwanted. And so now abortion is going to be used as a means of birth control. And, you know, I've been a lifetime Republican. If you would have asked me a decade ago, I probably would have taken the label of pro-life. But that label has been so dramatically warped now that I would never say that, because if you talk about that case, those cases of abortion, so purely elective, the woman's pregnant, it's inconvenient, it's unwanted, it's whatever it is, those are elective. I don't have a uterus, and the only way I'm going to get pregnant is if we have a second immaculate conception. And so I don't really think I have a stake in this, and I shouldn't be dictating it. And I also think other old white men in our legislature probably shouldn't be legislating this either. If the public of Idaho wants to set some reasonable limits, that's fine. I'm fine with that. That's a whole different situation. So let's put that to the side. What we're talking about is two other kinds of situations. The first is, the woman is pregnant. Everybody's excited. You go in and at 6 weeks or 8 weeks, whatever, and you hear that heartbeat, and it's like, oh my gosh, there's a real baby in there, and you're so excited. And then you come and you're going to have, you know, at some point in that second trimester, you're going to have your first ultrasound where you're now actually going to see this developing baby. And, you know, people are so excited and it's wonderful. They want that baby. So we're talking about a very different situation now. And then, unfortunately, I've personally experienced, you go in all excited, they're doing this ultrasound, and then all of a sudden, okay, why don't you wait here? We need to get the doctor. And what mm-hmm. you find out is there is something seriously, seriously wrong with that baby. Might be a genetic defect. There are defects where, like the brain doesn't form. There's very severe things that we know that the woman could continue carrying that pregnancy because it can be supported with the mother's blood supply, but mm-hmm. either it's going to be stillborn or it's going to die very shortly after delivery in the mom's arms. Now, there might be moms that say, that's what I want. Fine. But there are a lot of other moms who, when they're pregnant like that and showing, everybody wants to ask them about their baby and all that stuff. And it's going to be a painful reminder every day that I'm carrying a child that will never grow up and never survive. And I think this is not pro-life, because you're not going to change. If the mother carries that baby even to term, that baby will not survive. So it's not pro-life. All it is it's a terrible intrusion into a highly traumatic situation for that mom, for the spouse, the family, to know that she's going to have to carry that pregnancy. That's terrible. Now, the third case is, and we couldn't do a termination then because the woman's not going to die. She's going to survive. Mm-hmm. It's just she's going to have mm-hmm. to carry that pregnancy. Now, the third case is a woman, again, really wants this baby, very excited, but something terrible happens later. And now the only way to save the mother is to terminate that pregnancy. And either that, and it may not be clear that the mother's going to die, but maybe the mother's going to develop heart failure or kidney failure or other things that will affect the mom. I've always thought those are difficult decisions. And frankly, if God forbid that would have happened with my wife and I would have hoped we could make the decision, should we terminate the pregnancy or do we want to continue to put my wife at danger? And I think that's a tough decision that we ought to make. Instead, the legislature saying, oh, no, here's the answer. We're going to tell you how to do it. That's just not consistent with limited government, and it's just horribly cruel. And we're not serving any purpose because you're not saving that baby's life. That baby is not going to be able to survive if the mother doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Really good points, Dr. Pate. Appreciate that perspective. So Dr. Pate, Martha sent us this question and she writes, when I went to a local pharmacy to get my spring COVID booster, I'm over 65, I was told by the pharmacist giving me the shot that the vaccine is controversial. When I asked why, he said that it had been discovered that some information had been censored, including that ivermectin is effective in treating COVID. I was shocked and speechless to be hearing this from the pharmacist putting the vaccine in my arm. Is there any reliable evidence to his assertion?
No. In fact, the evidence is quite clear and compelling. And I think if anybody looked at it objectively with an open mind, the only conclusion is ivermectin doesn't prevent getting COVID and it does not do anything to benefit you in treating COVID. We have done great quality studies, double-blinded, randomized trials now, very big trials. And I wrote in my blog, there's three studies now that we have that really just should put the nail in this coffin. I know there's some doctors still promoting this, but there's just not a lick of science to support that. So mm-hmm. Your shock was well placed and I would get a new pharmacist.
And then Donna wrote in, and she wrote in just during the show today, Dr. Pate, and she says, I just tried to call the number given on my most recent COVID test kits to find the new expiration date. And it seems the government is no longer giving information about new expiration dates. And then she says, really? With a question mark.
You know, I'm not sure what you were looking at, and I haven't checked in a little while, but the FDA's website, the last time I checked, did have those updated expiration dates. So I would go to the FDA site. If it was the FDA site you checked and they're not showing it, then I'll see what I can do to help you. But go to the FDA site. I think you'll find it there.
Well, Dr. Pate, as always, we just so appreciate your time and, of course, your expertise on all of this. So really, thank you for spending the hour with us today. It's much appreciated.
Thank you, Gemma.
And remember, if you have a public health question for Dr. Pate, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu, and we will do our best to answer it next week. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.